From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour has been made in the past several nights in the city of Rochester and in cities across this country. And as we've been talking about, we have seen the peaceful demonstrations, but the urgent and passionate demonstrations. We've seen anger and pain and tears. In some places, in many places, we've seen the protests depart and some amount of chaos. And as I mentioned recently here, I think it's worth emphasizing, the mayor of Rochester, Lovely Warren, says this city was seeing strong, powerful, important, and peaceful demonstrations and was then baited by people who don't care about those demonstrations but wanted cover to do damage to this city. So when the mayor initially came out and said they were outsiders, it was an interesting sort of confluence across the country on Saturday night of mayors of Denver and Chicago and Rochester saying it was outsiders doing the damage. The police chief here said so. The sheriff of Monroe County said so. The county executive. By the next day, the mayor was essentially making it clear that this is metaphoric. That yes, some of the people who did some of the damage are local, many of them. But it's not a matter of sort of physical location. It's a matter of people who are part of a movement, part of progress, or not. And that's what she said we can't fall into. We've got to stick with the progress, keep our eyes on what needs to change, and move forward here. And we continue with the conversation this hour. I welcome back Danielle Ponder, Diversity and Inclusion Officer for the Monroe County Public Defender's Office. Danielle, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Jonathan Nithkatha is back with us. Easy for me to say, Jonathan, actor, performance educator with Impact Interactive and an adjunct professor. Welcome back. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Anthony Hall, Dean at Virtus Charter School for Young Men and Executive Director of Book Bags Express, is back with us. Anthony, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And Justin Morris, a community activist and the founder of Untrapped Ministries. Justin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks again for having me, Evan.
Well, so in the interest of opening up the conversation, for those who have already emailed the program saying you should be talking to police, please know that we will try to do that later this week. We made a conscious decision today to try to have exclusively black voices and guests from a range of views, but black leadership and voices and guests today. That's important to us. That's what we have scheduled. We are reaching out to police. We will try to have those conversations. We will have many more conversations around these various topics this week. If you want to join the conversation, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Anthony Hall, as we look to move forward here, are you an optimist that we're on the brink of actual substantive change?
Yes, definitely am. I think it's important that from a historical standpoint, what took place in the 60s on Joseph Avenue and sparked on Joseph Avenue and eventually went throughout the city, that was a pivotal point. I think particularly to Rochester, a pivotal point for Rochester. We can come out of the ashes and prevail.
Justin Morris, do you feel that optimism?
I'm kind of on the seesaw with it. I think what's going on around the country is happened before. I think we're gaining a little bit more traction in this particular instance, but I'm on the fence with the optimism. I think in order for true change to occur, we need a real revolution, and that can entail so many different things. But I think locally here in our city, I think we kind of set ourselves back more so than forward.
Why do you think we set ourselves back?
I think with everything that occurred this weekend, I think, you know, being in the community and being a part of different areas, I don't see what we accomplished with the looting and the rioting that took place. I don't feel as though we advanced our agenda as a people and as a community. I think a lot of people took advantage of a situation that presented itself, and we're still yet to see what's going to come of that. So, I'm on the fence.
Okay, and Danielle, you seem to I think it sounds to me at least separate the powerful, peaceful movement that you saw with some of what we saw after that. Is that fair?
I mean, the movement that started earlier was led by Ashley Gant and Iman Abid. They had someone even lead us in a meditation in the beginning. I mean, it was folks from all over Rochester there. It was really such a powerful thing. Where it went was not under the leadership of those two individuals. The folks that came in, and I actually did see some of them early on and approached them and said to them, do not start anything in here because black folks are most likely going to be the folks that suffer. Those same individuals were later seen on top of cars and, you know, in some of the other activity. So I can unequivocally say to you, this had nothing to do with the New York Civil Liberties Union and the march that initiated earlier on in the day. What happened in the evening was just a different group of individuals. And I think that it was easy for it to turn into that situation, especially when there are certain communities. As I keep saying, they say folks fell into a trap, but you're looking at people who are living in a neighborhood that they don't even believe is worth preserving or that they don't have pride in. And so we have to think about poverty and think about how do we have encouraged pride in our young people. And we can't do that by consistently ignoring them for decades.
So let me ask all four of you then about two separate but important questions. The first is on allyship, what that actually means. And then the second is on what you want to see government do. But as Danielle mentioned, Iman said during that protest, she addressed white members of the crowd directly in terms of what they were hoping they would do in that moment. So one of the things she said is, you know, get in front of people, you know, kind of form barriers. Please be present, be there, put yourselves in that in the line if you need to, but also let other people lead. So I think that understanding what allyship is important in a protest, but also going forward in a movement. Danielle, what do you need from people right now?
I mean, I totally agree. I think the fact, and I'm seeing a lot of information, a lot of people on Facebook, especially some young white kids who I'm not going to say what groups they identify with, but they felt that they were doing good by coming to this march. But if you can't come to a march and be under the leadership of people of color, then you're not doing good. So absolutely, it's listening to folks of color and asking them what they need. I have to say, Evan, I have been seeing that consistently on Facebook. Actually, someone just sent me a gift card saying, I don't know how to help, but here's a gift card. Right now, Yoga for a Good Hood is doing a fundraiser. They're close to $7,000 right now. Folks are saying, who do we give money to? The Avenue Black Box Theater is doing a fundraiser. So I think it's asking folks of color, what do you need? How do I help? And really just following the lead of black folks and of folks of color. And unfortunately, there were some white folks at the march who did not do that. But there have been tons of folks who are looking for opportunities to help.
Okay. Jonathan, what does that allyship look like going forward?
Yeah. I thank you, Danielle, for that, because that is 100% where I'm coming from. Folks need to be present. They need to be open. They need to be quiet. And they got to be in step with the people who are leading this. It's kind of the notion of asset-based community development versus community service. And that's something I try to teach our students is community services. We typically say, I'm going to go and clean up this area, or I'm going to go and do this particular thing. Whereas asset-based community development asks, first of all, it does an inventory of the skills and what you can actually offer, then asks the community, how can you utilize my skills to fulfill the work you are already doing? That's the difference. We're conditioned to thinking, I'm going to go and help by serving in the soup kitchen, and then I'll go back home and I don't think about the other ways in which my skills could have actually served the community in a positive way. And so I think opening up our minds, instead of doing community service for ourselves and for our own sense of well-being, instead of doing that, we're looking to offer what we have. If it's money for a gift card, if it's picking up groceries for someone, if it's noticing, like my neighbor said, I'm going crazy thinking about these folks who can't get formula for their babies, and saying, you know, putting it out there, if you need formula, if you need milk for your babies, let me know, I'll drop it off. There are little things you can do. No thing is too small, but it starts with you saying, what is it that you need? How can you use what I have to offer? That's allyship. And then I think also what you said at the top of this segment with the question about getting the police into this conversation is saying that this segment is for Black voices. I think that that's a level of allyship that needs to be echoed, in that being unequivocally and unapologetically focused on the realities of Black people and letting that be the truth and the reality, not sugarcoating it, not modifying it to fit our palate, but instead letting it be there. If someone needs to cry, needs to rage, needs to just be quiet, be there for that. And don't put your worldview or your sense of comfort around it to sort of give it a place to exist. I think that's what allyship looks like to me.
Okay. Anthony Hall, what do you think?
I think Danielle and the gentleman definitely hit it on the head. To add, white folks going back into their communities and having a conversation about institutional racism, structural racism, having that open dialogue and forum, and inviting some of us in those spaces to have that conversation and bring more awareness around it and what it looks like and what it feels like when I'm walking down the street, and as well as in their community when I'm walking or driving through their community. So definitely, as Danielle stated, you know, it's very important that the community knows that there was a separate a group of people that instigated the rioting and looting. I went to them directly. I know exactly the group. I went to them directly and told them to leave. Some of them I escorted from the protest with other group of men in the community. So, you know, we definitely, in my opinion, man, the allies, we need them, but they have to take direction from us.
Justin Morris, what do you think?
I think what allyship looks like is even with you know, our white counterparts, everything that was said is true, but I think it's a two-layer orange. You peel back that layer, and then you have a layer of Black privilege that exists too. And I don't think that message is always communicated clearly for those who are most vulnerable in this community. I think sometimes we advocate from the standpoint of what we see wrong in the community, and we never really get a true understanding from the people that are suffering of what's going on. So, you know, I may be in a different place in my life or in my everyday struggle than some of the people that I'm advocating for, but I'm advocating from the standpoint of what I see exists instead of getting a true understanding of what's really going on with the people in these neighborhoods, and why are we really marching, and why are we really protesting, and what is the foundation of what we're really trying to change in these communities that are being underserviced for Black and brown people throughout the United States. So a lot of times you have people advocating for a group of people when they don't really know the true needs of those people, whether it be Black or white.
Let me read from what was just published about an hour ago by President Obama, his thoughts on what should come next here. He weighs in, and this is an extended part of that, so bear with me as I read some of the president's words, and then I'm going to turn it over to our guests, not only to respond to President Obama, I should say the former president's words. We'll respond to that, but then we'll also talk about where they think we need to see the actual mechanism of government start to move next. So here's what President Obama writes today. Quote, I've heard some suggest that the recurrent problem of racial bias in our criminal justice system proves that only protests and direct action can bring about change, and that voting and participation in electoral politics is a waste of time. I couldn't disagree more. The point of protest is to raise public awareness, to put a spotlight on injustice, and to make the powers that be uncomfortable. In fact, throughout American history, it's often only been in response to protest and civil disobedience that the political system has even paid attention to marginalized communities. But eventually, aspirations have to be translated into specific laws and institutional practices. And in a democracy, that only happens when we elect government officials who are responsive to our demands. Moreover, it's important for us to understand which levels of government have the biggest impact on our criminal justice system and police practices. When we think about politics, a lot of us focus only on the presidency and the federal government. And yes, we should be fighting to make sure that we have a president, a Congress, a U.S. Justice Department, and a federal judiciary that actually recognizes the ongoing corrosive role that racism plays in our society and want to do something about it. But the elected officials who matter most in reforming police departments and the criminal justice system work at the state and local levels. It's mayors and county executives that appoint most police chiefs and negotiate collective bargaining agreements with police unions. It's district attorneys and state's attorneys that decide whether or not to investigate and ultimately charge those involved in police misconduct. Those are all elected positions. In some places, police review boards with the power to monitor police conduct are elected as well. Unfortunately, voter turnout in these local races is usually pitifully low, especially among young people, which makes no sense given the direct impact these offices have on social justice issues, not to mention the fact that who wins and who loses those seats is often determined by just a few thousand or even a few hundred votes. So the bottom line for me is this. If we want to bring about real change, then the choice isn't between protest and politics. We must do both. End quote. That's President Obama weighing in today. Daniel Ponder, what do you think?
I completely agree with what he said. I do think that there has to be some responsibility put on elected officials. Many of the reasons that people of color, specifically the African-American community, are kind of can be apathetic toward voting is because they haven't seen much change in their community. So what I would love to see our local elected officials do, who have so much power in our criminal justice system, is to get together and create a plan. What is our plan to make sure that we don't have a George Floyd in our community? What is our plan to make sure that we don't have an Eric Garner in our community? Show our young people that it is worth voting for you, that it is worth going to the poll, because once you get elected, you actually do something. So I completely agree with what President Obama said, but we have to take some responsibility that for so many people of color, we have not seen any change. And if when you don't see change, that leads to hopelessness and that leads to apathy. So from the county executive to the mayor to the police chief, there needs to be a plan on how we are going to fix the systemic problems within our law enforcement institutions.
Jonathan Nethketha, what do you think?
Yeah, wow. I'm just letting all that simmer and sit. It's the responsibility that we have as voters. You know, we every single piece of our lives, I think, in connection to our government is colored with apathy and cynicism, and it's a difficult cycle to break. And I agree that when you look at the youth and we try to put the youth forward and put a lot on their shoulders, we do so, again, without really listening to them and really examining what is different today from what is different from yesterday. One of the things that I often look to, especially when it comes to issues between the police and our community, because there are members of our community who are the police and folks who are really about that life of making sure that our communities are connected, is looking at the next levels, looking at the judges, looking at the legislature, looking at the laws that get put into place. And there's a tremendous amount of work. And I know, Danielle, you've been doing so much great work in that arena to really speak for people. But we need to continue to have a presence and a place there. You know, oftentimes the folks who are writing these laws and passing these laws don't have to live with the effect of it, but we do. And if we are focused on that level, if we can put energy towards education and in connection to that level and helping our young folks know that, yes, you can be a district attorney, you can be a public defender, you can be a judge. And these are the ways to make that happen. A lot of that is what's missing, and we're missing the connection between all the levels of our community. And we have those things connected. That's when we can realize the change. And also, while we're looking at ourselves, We also need to make sure that the rest of the world and the other communities are looking at themselves as well. Why is it that our district attorney's office, and I'm not saying ours, but ask the question, you know, what is the makeup of the people in our district attorney's office? What is the makeup of the people in this room who are making these laws and these rules? What are the voices that are not here? That's work that we as a community, we can't do. If we have difficulty understanding the people's voices and why things are systemically not changing, then we have to put the onus on the folks who are looking to redistrict and rewrite these lines. Like, we can do a lot of work, but the work that we do will fall flat and will continue to breed more apathy if other work is not being done simultaneously in these other areas. So whereas I do feel we have responsibility, and I do agree that voting can get us to that point, there's accountability at these other levels with the rest of our society that needs to be reckoned with in order for us to have the change that we're saying we want.
All right, Anthony Hall, what do you think?
So definitely at a national level, he's 100% correct. So at a national level, I understand that, you know, there's people in those offices that don't reflect us as well as the views. Locally, there's people in these seats that reflect us and have some of our lived experiences, and yet we're still dealing with a police department of hatred, bigotry, racism, as well as a city, as the brother talked about redlining, lines that's been put forth and including us to one area of the city. So I believe that not only voting, but the people bend the will of government. And I think that's what former President Obama was talking about, the people. I believe that, you know, during this time, I'm actually conducting a community meeting today at 5 p.m. at 471 Hudson Avenue. And I've been inundated with inboxes in regards to how can I help, what can I do, what does it look like, what's the next steps. So it's the people, and the demands have to be placed on the table. And they have to be demands. Like I said, historically, out of riots, our people put forth demands, not ask, not request, but demands. And these things have to happen. So we definitely, voting is very powerful at the local level, very powerful, particularly in this community. And until we change those that's in power, we have a huge battle ahead.
Justin Morris, what do you think?
Agreeance with former President Obama. It's actually like a cardinal sin here in Rochester to speak against leadership, because they do reflect this, and so many people are afraid to speak up and speak out against them. So what you see is, you see the same people occupying the same spaces year after year after year. They term out on the ledge. They go and they run for a different office or a different seat. And you got 30, 40 years in politics, and you got a community that suffered every one of those years. I've seen a bunch of people saying, oh, why wouldn't we protest and riot and loot in Rochester? Look at the national average. Look where we're at on the national average of poverty, of the school board, or different things of that nature. And I just looked and I said, these are the same people that are in support of the people that are in the seats right now. And if anybody knows me and Anthony, you know, we're very vocal about the leadership in this community and holding them in the office that they hold accountable. So much so to the point where it's a lot of people in this community that want nothing to do with us because of us being so vocal about those seats and those offices. So I'm 100% with Obama on the local level. I'm not even going to talk about the national level, but I think that it's vitally important that us, the people in this community who are affected by the laws that are on the book, who are affected by the decisions that are being made on a daily basis, have to really, really, really pay attention and start to vote different, start to hear new voices in this community and really, really, really decipher, okay, what's going to benefit me and my future generations, or, you know, do I want to go with status quo, and do I want the same thing to continue that's been going on for the last 40, 50 years in this community? I mean, it's time for change. Change is here. We got a bunch of important seats that's coming up that you know, the pendulum can shift. So I really want to encourage people out there, man. If it's not working, vote it out. Vote it out. And that may hurt a lot of people's feelings, but if it's not working, vote it out.
Well, let me read an email from Teresa, who says, has some remarks on policing that dovetail with some of the other feedback we've gotten. So Teresa says, the mayor's focus on outside disruptors seems designed to deflect from systemic problems that were on full display on Saturday. In Rochester, we can't even implement the basic police accountability that the governor advocates, such as an independent review board and transparent disciplinary records of violent cops that the mayor has opposed. Let's not forget it was the RPD that led with violence on Saturday. They fired pepper bullets at a DNC photojournalist when she was filming. They attacked protesters with tear gas. Our police met a protest against police brutality with brutality. Adam writes to say, Evan, this is about police culture, culture, culture. Look at Slate's headline, Slate.com, writing about an uprising of police violence. That was their headline from the weekend. And Adam writes to say, you got to change the culture, culture, culture. Danielle, let me start with you on this. So I had a conversation with a couple of guys this weekend from my home state of Ohio. I've literally never met them in person. I know them through sports fandom of Cleveland sports. But they're two white guys, and they are brothers, and they are both police officers. And they told me they agree with the culture critique. They said that too often they felt like in their rise through the ranks, the elevation of people and the recruitment is about the people who have had, you know, in their words, again, I'm just reciting what they told me, people who are much more comfortable sort of being jerks, being bullies, and probably had some issues. They told me about a 1990 study that I had not seen before that indicated that as many as 40% of police officers have had domestic violence in their own past. I have not seen an updated study on that. But their point to me reflected these emails, which was, we have to change the mindset, the culture of what policing mm-hmm. is about. Mm-hmm. And if we don't do that, then, you know, we're really sort of going nowhere with reforms. I mean, that's a strong statement. I don't know how to do it. And I also want to eventually leave space later this week. We'll talk to officers. But I want to ask you first, do you agree with those critiques?
God, I think it's such a true statement. I'm so happy they said that, because I do think that we keep missing the root cause. And the problem is, we have a police system that is it's replete with institutional racism, where bullying is allowed, where abuse is acceptable. I mean, working in the public defender's office, I've seen thousands of body cams that could have led to, where situations could have led to a George Floyd situation. What's very telling on that George Floyd video is that the other officers did not look shocked or alarmed at what that officer was doing. Nothing in them suggested that this was abnormal. I have four brothers, and three of my four brothers have been beat up by police officers. This is a part of the culture. And if you can't do it for Black folks, and if you are a family member of someone who's an officer, or you aspire to be an officer, think about that rookie cop who goes into this institution thinking that he is going to do good work. And that rookie cop is going to have a rude awakening, and he's going to have to make some difficult decisions about whether he turns a blind eye or whether he speaks to a veteran cop and says, you can't do that. I've seen it happen in court. I've seen a veteran cop testify and completely lie, and then the rookie cop come up next and trying to struggle with what he should do in that moment. So not only is it killing our community, if you can't see that, and why you wouldn't be able to see that, I don't know. But think about the officers who want to go into these positions to do good. It's going to be so difficult for them because we have propped up a racist institution, and we are afraid to call it that. And if we don't call it that, then we can't change it.
Can I ask though how are we going to get to a recruiting that really does reframe that? I mean, in a serious way, if the if this is an accurate critique of police departments across the country, who leads that change, Daniel?
Obviously, I mean, I think the chief of police has to lead that change. Mm-hmm. Every chief of police and mayor of every city should be coming out with a plan to reimagine their police departments. One thing I think should happen is every officer should have to spend a year in the community volunteering before you get a gun to police people. And many of them haven't even had encounters with Black folks before they now have a gun and on the street. You should spend a year volunteering in a community organization with youth of color. Implicit bias training should be mandatory for every officer. We really need to be able to interview officers on racial biases, on their experiences with racism, on their experience with people of color. We need to be asking them, have they worked in communities of color? Have they worked in communities that are of a low socioeconomic status? But most of all, Evan, there has not been, no one came out and said, you know what, the lootings were terrible. The anger in the community is terrible. We are all immediately getting together, recognizing there is a crisis, and we are coming up with a strategic plan to ensure that our city is not next, that our officers mm-hmm. don't end up in this situation, because it also hurts the officers. I truly do not believe that these officers want to murder people, but I believe that there is a system that allows them to do reckless behavior. And that reckless behavior is likely to lead to the death of people, because stepping on someone's neck was never seen as a problem until George Floyd died. But that should never be acceptable. So we are harming everyone involved. We are harming the officers who want to do good. We are harming the Black community. And we are not seeing this as a crisis. The looting became a crisis. Mm. But the systemic racism in police institutions has not been seen as a crisis.
All right. And just one more for you, Danielle, before I turn to the other guests here. Here's a comment from, of all people, the Jeopardy guy, Ken Jennings, the dude who won all those Jeopardies. This is shared tens of thousands of times. He writes this week, let's just give tactical gear and near unlimited authority to some of the dumber guys from your high school. What could go wrong? Is that too broad a brush, or do you do you think the spirit of that's correct? Do you think that's what police departments are?
I mean, I won't call them dumb, but what I will say is that we are giving limited training. I read that in, I believe it was Sweden, that police officers have to do 2 years of training before they can even join the force. We are giving them limited training. They're regular human beings with emotions, and we're giving them guns. Officers are like you and me. They get angry at people. They can be enraged. But guess what? They have guns and they have authority. And so that is what concerns me. I'm not saying they're dumb folks from high school. I'm saying they're human beings. And human beings make mistakes. And if we're not making sure we can create a flawed-proof system or fail-proof system for these officers, we're putting them in danger and we're putting the Black community in danger.
Okay, Jonathan.
Yeah. So to the question of how do we start this, I mean, in adding to the list that Danielle put together, you know, I think it's getting the voices of those officers. And again, I acknowledge with this culture that there is a protectiveness, that it's insular, and that there are walls that they say is very thin, but it's almost impenetrable, where they like to handle things inside, and they have their culture that many of us, unless we are connected to it on a regular basis or a part of it, we really don't understand the pressures and the realities that are in there. And former retired police officer, RPD officer, and deputy chief Wayne Harris shared on Facebook this past weekend, and I'll just share it. He said that we, the police of America, the retired police of America, the unions and FOPs must change how we are doing business. It's up to us to evaluate our tactics and ensure that they are serving our communities honorably. And it's also up to us to come to terms with our history, however difficult that may be. I think that's the other part of the equation, because again, when we always focus on the recipients of oppression to be the ones to change culture, it's never going to take root. We need the people who know that something's wrong to give them the opportunity to change it and to help and have them help inform us on those different steps. What does that community service look like then? And we get led and we have information that is shared by people who served and who have a positive track record in the community. And these are the breaking down those walls are the tougher parts of it. You know, I'll share my sons and Evan, you've met them. They, you know, this has been really difficult for 7 and 8, almost 9 year old, mm-hmm. With all of these news and all of these images. And, you know, I had read, one of them came across me reading a story from Buffalo about former officer Carol Horn, and almost a decade ago lost her job for intervening when an officer was choking a subject, and she's lost all of her appeals. And it's a really interesting and sad story. And my son was like, you know, that's one reason why I don't want to be a police officer. I don't want to get faced with charges for stopping a bad officer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never tell my sons, I never preach fear of the police, because I want to find a way to break that cycle, that thing that has been ingrained in me since I was a kid. But at the same time, I'm asked to juggle the positivity, the way that I ask him to wave to police officers, but then the reality that could shift at a moment's notice, depending upon how quickly he grows or where he might be at a particular moment in time. So I think making sure the police and those good police officers who we celebrate are empowered to help us change that narrative and to do it from the inside as well. The Police Accountability Board, we thought was a great step. I still believe in that. So let's, instead of tearing it down as to something that's beating up and destroying a culture, it's making things better and hopefully making it easier for police officers to do their job, knowing that the community is behind them instead of expecting the worst from them. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, being a parent of a young Black child right now is so difficult. But these conversations, they happen and they need to happen. And if I'm having this conversation, then everybody else better be having this conversation wherever they're at.
Anthony Hull, what do you think?
Definitely. So what first I would say is, and he brought up a great point about retired Deputy Chief Wayne Harris. I think it's good that he spoke out, but we need those that are active in duty to speak out. When he was Deputy Chief, he spoke out in regards to the brutality within the department. Right now we have an active Black chief, and we need him to be bold. We need him to be bold and hold his officers, his rank and file, accountable. We cannot keep allowing band-aids on gaping wounds. You know, kids in our community are being beat, arrested wrongfully, and detained. This cannot happen. And we need a chief that's going to say, no, this is not going to happen on my watch. Also, the RPD is a contracted agency with the city of Rochester, excuse me. And we need to look at that bargaining agreement. We need to, if something happens in this community, to prevent something from happening in this community, we need to make sure that, listen, if you kill somebody, your pension is gone, you're fired. You know, those are bold and innovative ways to assure that, you know, we don't get an Eric Garner, that we don't get a George Floyd. You know, it's not safe proof, but it definitely ensures, because there's people's livelihoods that are at stake. When you're out there and you know that, oh, I can put my knee on somebody's neck for 8 minutes and nothing's going to come out of it, then the culture is definitely going to allow other officers to be more boastful and doing acts of brutality. So holding them accountable at the highest standard is very, very important. And that, like I said, that goes with the bargaining agreement. The mayor just put forth the proposed budget for this year. They went to each union within the police union to talk about monies in that bargaining agreement, and council is going to vote on it. So within there. That's something that doesn't have to take, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. That's something that we can start right now for next year, budget cycle, to have that conversation and put forth bold restraints on that budget and that agreement.
We will, I should say, excuse me, we should talk more about that later this week as we talk more about actual proposals from local budgets, as Anthony talks about, to immunity for officers. And there's just a lot more that we will discuss in depth when we talk about reforms. Justin Morris, how do you see this? Do you agree with Anthony there?
Those officers who want to kill will put them in themselves in a position to do so. Danielle Ponders said something earlier about that rookie cop. While that is a reality, there is more so a reality of cops who get in this for the wrong reason, because mm-hmm. they see the amount of power that they have. They see the amount of authority that they'll have. And every man and every woman wants to be powerful. And what better way to do it than the culture that exists within American policing? It is sickening to see simple traffic stops escalate into murders of innocent black men and women. It is sickening to see simple altercations escalate to the point where we're burying our loved ones because they didn't see eye to eye with an officer. So the level of power that exists in that vein has to be dealt with. That statement that was made, are they you give a bunch of jock tactical gear and different things like that. I don't agree with them being dumb, but we're not looking at a lot of valedictorians that are joining the police department. So when you look at that notion and you look at why people are joining and, you know, what do they want to accomplish? When you're looking at police departments that sometimes 90% of the officers that are on active duty don't live in the community, what community are they trying to protect and serve? A lot of times, and me having a criminal justice background in corrections, I know the culture. I know the culture in and out, and I know what people get off on in that culture. So, you know, and when those guys come through, you know, corrections and they bring that energy, you just know that's what they're in it for. So, you know, we could try to sugarcoat this, and I'm going to teach my son, you know, the realities that exist there because it could cost him his life. I'm going to teach my daughter the realities that a 10-year-old right here in our community can be put in handcuffs and her mother can come to get her and they still transport her away from the police scene, take her to a police station, take her in the police station, and then bring her out the front door. Oh, she wasn't arrested. That's an arrest. And that's mm-hmm. a message being sent forth by the people who are supposed to be protecting us in this community, mm-hmm. that no matter what you say, our word is going to be supreme.
And I have to completely, you know, I agree with Justin, and I just want to clarify, you know, that my intent is not to sugarcoat at all. There's definitely officers who joined the force with a racist mindset. But I guess my point is speaking to people who have said things to me like, well, my son wants to be a cop, white people. My son wants to be a cop, and he's going to do a great job, and he's going to be a good cop. And how difficult that is going to be for him because we're not acknowledging how tainted the system is and that he's more likely to be tainted by the racism of the system than he is to be this great cop who's going to change the system because it's
right,
so deeply entrenched.
That's a great point, Dan.
So let me try to squeeze in as much feedback as we can before the end of the hour. And I'm going to start with Beatrice in Webster. Go ahead, Beatrice.
Hi, Evan. Evan, may I ask you a question?
You can do whatever you like, Beatrice.
Evan, I was wondering, why won't there be, it should be, I should say, a black cop and a white cop going out together in their cars? And also, I was wondering, how easy is it to break in those windows at those establishments mm-hmm. that they claim that the protesters did? Is it easy for them to break that kind of glass? And if they did break it, what kind of weapons did they bring with them on the protest? We didn't see any.
Beatrice, thank you for the phone call. So I don't know how strong the glass is in various places, whether it's cars or the front row. The bottom floor of stores. I know there's a lot of reinforcement of that happening. You know, some people showed up at the demonstration. I mean, did you see the picture by Jamie Germano from the Democrat and Chronicle of a white man in a cowboy hat with a crowbar swinging at the window of a car? That person was pretty clearly not there to support Black Lives Matter. So I think some people came ready to do actual damage. As for the proposal of just putting as she says, a white cop and a black cop and have them come out together, Danielle Ponder, having worked in the system, what do you make of that proposal from Beatrice?
I'm just going to be very blunt and say I don't think that will work. I think, unfortunately, black cops can be tainted by the same culture because I've seen it done hundreds of times. I know a lot of people think if we just have more black cops, that's going to solve the problem. You know, I lived in Nigeria for a small period of time where there were all black cops and it was terrible. But the point is, black cops can come into that system. And if the culture is such where we disrespect people, if the culture is such where we pull people over for minor offenses and talk to them like they are nothing, then they're likely to repeat that culture as well. So I think what we all have been trying to say is that there has to be a radical culture shift, and that's just not going to happen by placing in black cops.
Okay. Let me get Jim in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jim.
Look, there's an old axiom that's been around, and it came from the majority community, and it says that doctors and police officers have a license to kill. Lawyers have a license to steal. And if you understand that, and if you understand what's behind the onion and start peeling it away, you have to understand what you're dealing with. Now, there are some good police officers in the system throughout the United States. And once they've had enough and they say, we're going to weed out the bad cops, then you're going to have some changes. But as long as that veil of secrecy prevails among the troops, nothing's going to happen. And one other thing, Rochester has a unique history because one of the events that led to the big riots here in 1964, it was a black guy, Rufus Farewell, I think his name was, that owned a service station on the corner of Plymouth and Columbia Avenue. Columbia Avenue, deadhead central Plymouth. And he was cleaning up one night in his own business. He owned the service station. And some Rochester police officers came in there and beat him unmercifully and in his own station. What are you doing in here, boy? Blah, 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 blah. And that's been well documented. So until this type of attitude, philosophy about policing stops, we're going to have the same problem over and over. And what do they say? The answer of stupidity is keep doing the same thing over and over and keep getting the same result. So I would like to hear the people, commentators respond to that.
Jim, always good to hear from you. Thank you. Justin Morris, you've worked in the system. You have a lot of experience helping people. What do you make of Jim's comments there?
It's basically an echo of what I was saying. Well, it's an echo of what he's saying. He's the elder. But I think he's spot on. I think he's seen it. And I think, you know, in his statement, he's 100% right about not something that's just going on in this generation, but that's been going on for generation after generation after generation. Blue reigns supreme in America, and until that's changed or until that's challenged, we're not going to go anywhere. So earlier when I've made the statement that I've made that I'm on the fence, because I know how powerful that blue shield is. And until we really, 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 really make efforts to change this narrative on many different levels, then they're not going anywhere.
All right. So a different Jim and Michael and Penfield both called asking for specific action items. We've got 2 minutes left. You've got about 25 seconds apiece. We're ripping down the list here. Jonathan Nithketha, as short as you can do it, give me a couple of action items. What's next? What has to happen?
What has to happen is that we need to have we have to listen to the people who organize us. And in terms of people of color, in terms of black people, when our sisters organize us and our brothers sustain us and our elders guide us, we allow our youth to invigorate us and we allow our ancestors to surround us, then our true allies will stand behind us. That's when we're going to make real change. And I think it has to be a cultural and a true change. Now, if you want an action item, the first step is taking a listen to what is happening and following the lead of people in these communities who are doing the work and who are finding the avenues. And if you can do that and you can be humble enough to take the lead of the people in these communities, then we're going to get a step in the right direction.
All right. And Ashley Gant, Stanley Martin, we'd love to have you on the program tomorrow to keep leading this conversation. Anthony Hall, real quick here, give me an action item or two.
Action item, organizing. Galvanizing our community and bringing forth real tangible solutions. Another is being bold, man. Holding people accountable. You got elected officials. They petition. They knock on doors. They make promises. It's time to hold them accountable in their respective places.
20 seconds, Justin Morris. An action item.
It's simple to me. Vote, 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 vote. And then if that doesn't work, vote again. New mayor, new chief, whatever the situation may be, vote. Get them out of there. Let's start over. Also, Evan, you should bring the community on with the police.
We're going to try to do that this year. Absolutely. And Daniel Ponder, 20 seconds. Give me an action item.
I'll just say for the elected officials, let's get together and let's make some real change. Let's come up with a strategic plan and let's implement it.
Daniel Ponder, Jonathan Nifketha, Anthony Hall, Justin Morris joining us from their various perspectives. Thank you for making the time for the program, and I hope we can all talk soon.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
And tonight, listeners, public radio listeners from across the country will gather for America, Are We Ready?, a national call-in about racism, violence, and our future together. Join the hosts Kai Wright, Brian Lehrer with Tanzina Vega from WNYC in New York, Angela Davis from Minnesota Public Radio, and other special guests for an important conversation. Tonight, 8 to 10 on WXXI. I'm Evan Dawson, Megan Mack, Rob Braden, the whole team. Thanks you for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.